I was asked, and I want to thank Patrick for organizing these things. I think that they're really a critical component of our ongoing discussion about interpretive methods and our ongoing deepening of our understanding of interpretive methods and the wide range of conceptualization of interpretive methods. So we are asked to talk about how we do what we do, how others might do it too, and to a lesser extent, why we do what we do. So that, of course, is a great setup for making one think about, you know, what do I do anyway? I don't categorize my work under one sort of interpretive method, although one of the things I am going to do today is talk about some of the points I made in Dvor Yenow and Peregrine Schwartz-Shea's recently published book, Interpretation and Method, Empirical Research Methods and the Interpretive Turn. And there I call what I do critical interpretation based on my first book, Beyond Appeasement. And in that book, though, what I also do is I critique narratives. I critique dominant narratives and I construct an alternative narrative. So I am very concerned with narrative. So I'm going to talk, first of all, about what I do sort of conceptually, and then go into some of the nuts and bolts of things that I worked out in doing that first book project. Then I'll talk a little bit about some of the methods, things I've been asked to write, and a book with Adi Klotz that will be coming out. And then I will talk about two current book projects that I'm working on, and I'm on leave now with a grant to do research for one that grows out of what should be a finished book but is still in process, a different one. But they're both related. And for one of those projects, I'm employing something of a genealogical approach, although it might be a little bit altered from some notions of genealogy. Okay. What is critical interpretation, and what else do I do, or how do I look at it? So I think part of it is subsumed under this notion of social construction. That is to say, if social construction is open to post-positivist and post-structuralist sources, methods, and understanding, then I'm happy to consider myself a social constructivist in part. But what I do is work that blends social theory and philosophy and actual practice, the empirical and substantive practice of groups of quote-unquote real people. I do work that looks at people as both agents and subjects. Sometimes I used to get a little frustrated with notions of subjectivity because I thought that they imposed certain identities on people too much and didn't allow them much in terms of agency. But I also understand the critique of notions of agency as agent, thinking of people as agents is really fitting into a kind of liberal framework that has its own problems. So I kind of work in between that, if you will. And I do work that focuses on intersections and contestations. Intersections between ethics and actions, contestations of dominant discourses or meta-narratives, and alternative discourses. I am interested in looking at the big questions, if you will, of philosophy. What is the good that people in the world want to result from their actions? And what are the muddled effects, the unintended effects, and the power relations that are produced, engendered, or reproduced by those actions? So for me, agents must act in the world. People have to act in the world. But whether we're in the academy, whether we're social movements, which I focus on, or in governmental politics, I think we always have to be wary of our own actions because, after all, we are shaped by power relations, what used to be called structure. I think we always need to be reflexive or reflective, and we always need to be critical of our own work. And I would like to think that my own work is an ongoing process, a work in progress. And one of the things that frustrates me in the academy is when people get a shtick and then defend it against all costs. So part of what I do is a reaction against that, I guess. I feel that I've grown tremendously after I became a professor as well as before, and I just want to continue doing that. That, to me, is the fun of being an academic. What have I done, and how did I do it, or how do I do it? Well, I'm going to focus a little bit. I'm not going to go in a lot to, you know, how I started to do what I did, but I do want to say that Devorah and Perry, in asking contributors to this book, they asked us all to write a little bit about how we started on our project. And I was just reading over mine. I'd totally forgotten that I'd written it last night. And I do think that one of the things I do tell graduate students is that, you know, this really isn't worth it unless you're passionate about what you do. And I started off with what my husband calls my first dissertation, which was something that I really wasn't sure that how to accomplish. And then I realized I was in Europe supposedly working on it, and I was working on it. But it was also in the 80s, and I was very involved with peace movements and things like that, and I decided, you know, this isn't really what I'm passionate about. So I went back to the hard case of the interwar movements. I thought, you know, what is this that I'm involved in, and what is the meaning of it, and all of that. So that's what I did for my dissertation and my first book. I found in doing this, and I'm going to focus some very specific remarks on the problems of sources and evidence collection. And for some of you, that might be more useful than for others, but there it is. I found my sources and conceptualizations both broad and narrow, and in my current projects, I'm finding that again. And I think that's frustrating, but I also find it exciting. So the evidence that, I mean, the advice that students often get to narrow your project, I think sometimes can narrow the interest. And I think that you need to think in terms of always be open to other kinds of evidence that might, you know, really reconfigure in some ways the project. I also think that one of the things I like about this particular session is that we're all bringing things in from various disciplines. And I think interdisciplinarity is a big thing. And I do want to be able to focus, you know, some comments today on the pragmatics of being an academic today. And I think increasingly it is okay to be interdisciplinary. And I know that on the one hand, people do need to think in terms of how am I going to market myself. But in other ways, one can think about, you know, the intellectual excitement of why you're in this in the first place. So don't close yourself off. And I think very pragmatically, you can still market yourself. All right, I want to talk about my experience in archives. I wrote a proposal for my dissertation, which got the Alice Paul Award, I'm not sure how, for best dissertation proposal by a woman in political science, way back in the late 80s. And I thought, great, and I sent off for all of these grant applications, and rejection, but two good ones came in at the very end. So I went off to Europe, and I did a lot of archival research in London, and outside of London, and in Washington, D.C., and in Geneva, Switzerland, about the interwar movements. So I want to say that I love archives, and I interacted a lot with historians, and I had to think, how deep do you get? How detailed do you get? Wait a minute, I'm a political scientist. What does that mean? And so some historians look at history in macro terms, and some in very, very micro terms. And without any training in archives, I was kind of thrown into this atmosphere of, you know, reading documents, of trying to figure out which documents to order. And we can talk more about that later if you want. But for me, a lot of it, I did waste some time, put it that way. But I also learned a lot in the process. So there were times when I would literally fall asleep at the table over documents, and there were times when I was just very excited and sort of transported into another place and time, I started writing in the passive more because in the interwar period, all the Brits wrote in the passive, and you know, it's just started driving me crazy when I, you know, came back after a while. But I want to give you a little bit of the collected wisdom from that particular experience. And then I want to think a little bit with you about how that experience, whether it's serving me now in my current projects or not. And I think that maybe you can just think about your own experience in that light. One of the things that I knew I wanted to do, people say, you know, what's your puzzle? What's your research hypothesis? Or for those who are more qualitative, what's your research puzzle? Or for me, it became, you know, these dominant interpretations of the interwar period and of peace movements during the interwar period, they don't really add up. They say on the one hand that they're to be blamed for all of these things like isolationism and appeasement. On the other hand, any studies that actually examine these things don't talk about peace movements as causes. So what gives? So what are these dominant interpretations, which I was also particularly interested in because as a graduate student at Columbia in the 80s, I was faced with dominant interpretations all the time of the security situation in the world and of what could be studied and what couldn't be studied. So I made the link with, you know, what's going on in the field and what's allowed to be studied and also what was going on at the time. So to me, looking at these meta-narratives, dominant discourses, these are just different ways of talking about this, is absolutely critical. And if you want to do critical interpretation, what a lot of people do is they stop there and they deconstruct these, and that's a very worthy enterprise. But I think the second step is to figure out whether or not you want to construct an alternative interpretation. I'm somebody who had been involved in peace movements, and I did want to construct an alternative interpretation, but I didn't want it just to be a sappy, they're all great kind of thing. And even now, I look at them differently than what I did when I did my dissertation and published my book. But I think that it's a methodological, it's an epistemological choice in a sense of whether one wants to construct an alternative interpretation. We can talk about that more as well. I did. I think if you're doing this kind of work where you want to merge, blend, you want to look at the intersection between theory and practice, conceptualizations and practice, dominant narratives and how people act in the world vis-a-vis those narratives, either reproducing or challenging or both, I think that you need a combination of primary and secondary evidence. And for my first project, it was enormous. And I think in reading some of your proposals, a couple of you are dealing with situations in which the evidence out there is just simply enormous. I was also going to the Public Record Office outside of London every day with historians who knew they needed to look at X documents because their advisors had told them that. Well, nobody had told me what I needed to look at. And I found that, you know, I knew that what I wanted to do was piece together things from both a peace movement perspective. In terms of text, I wanted to look at authoritative and not so authoritative sources in a sense, although I was talking to Lena at the break, I think that when I was looking at peace movement sources, I was looking for more the authoritative sources within those movements as well. Not exclusively, but somewhat. And I was looking for the tensions in these things. So I think that if we are constructing an alternative interpretation, that we do need to look at sources from a variety of perspectives. But there's also the problem of devising a method when sources are too numerous. And I think this is a very real problem. It's also a problem for what I'm doing now. So even though I say, yeah, you've got to look at things from a variety of perspectives, you've got to be open to all sorts of evidence. In my case, I needed to look at what governments were saying. I went to Geneva to look at League archives. I examined peace movement archives from a variety of sources. Even though there's that, you know, I could sense pretty early on into this project why a lot of historians examine the French reaction to Locarno from June 1926 to, you know, August 1927 or something like that, because it would be a hell of a lot easier. Anyway, that's not what I wanted to get at. And so, you know, I had to keep reminding myself that's not what I want to get at, is something that that selective. So I think that one of the things that I would say I learned from my experience is that the more time one spends before kind of thinking about the possibility of different sources, and I did. I went to archival guides and things like that before, but even so, the more you can figure out the pragmatics of what is where and think about what you're likely to find, what you think you're going to find, and think about which things you probably don't need to look at least right away. And that gives you some sort of blueprint or game plan for approaching archives. And I think that's also important. I also think it's really important then to understand the philosophical, the sort of science of philosophy problems of evidence accumulation. In our field, we usually talk about events being overdetermined. But as philosophers of science have pointed out, they're usually underdetermined. We can never prove them without a reasonable doubt. We have our interpretations, others have their interpretations. That's what historians do, is they argue over interpretations. But I think we need to think about criteria of coherence, criteria of plausibility, criticisms of those criteria, criteria of whether we're ignoring any major piece of evidence, criteria of logic of the explanations given the evidence. So I think we always need to realize that, in addition then, that any evidence we use, in my case any archive, any document, is also an interpretation. So it really is interpretation all the way down. I was fascinated by looking at, and I just lost myself for a while, looking at Austen Chamberlain, British Foreign Secretary's records from 19, I forget what it is now, 22 to 27, 28. I don't know if there's any British, interwar British experts here who can name the dates. But you know, this guy was amazing. One of you is doing something on aerial bombing. And it made me think of how he was talking about, yeah, we can bomb Egypt in 1922. We can bomb the savages. And we can, it's okay. In fact, we need to do that to bring them in line. And they're only partially independent now anyway. They're not fully independent. And so, you know, these kinds of things were made me stray a little bit, in a sense, because it's not exactly what I was doing. But it was fascinating then to look at these kinds of interpretations of his world. And he had an interpretation for the Americans, for the British, for the French, for the Germans. And you know, they were all the stereotypes you might normally think about. Americans as naive, you know, the French as impossible, the Germans as hard-headed, but he really liked Mussolini. So I think that there's the philosophical problems of evidence accumulation and the practical problems of evidence accumulation. And now there are a lot of software systems which I need to learn more about, and maybe some of you actually do know more about, to classify evidence. And I think those can be useful up to a point. But it's always also useful to go back and reread a document, because you do, you know, get a new understanding of it after you've read certain other documents or pieces of evidence. I think in putting the evidence together, people are using concepts of triangulation, triage, and things like that. And I do think those things are very important. I think that constant questioning, they help in the constant questioning and reexamination of one's own assumptions going into it. I can't say that my assumptions changed all that much, really, but I do think they were refined considerably. I think they've changed more after I did the project than, you know, the time doing it. But I do think this constant reevaluation of one's assumptions and projections, along with looking at the evidence, is really important when you're actually writing things up. And then I think that it's always important to be very self-reflexive about the ethical implications of your work. I think any of our work has ethical implications. We're all implicated in no matter what kind of work we do. And so I think that that's quite critical. Okay. So I think for me, what I'm doing now is I'm in the middle of a book project on looking at religious understandings of primarily Judeo-Christian and within that primarily Christian ethical tensions in understandings of the use of force over different historical periods in the 20th century to the present. I'm going back to the interwar period and looking at the just war pacifist debate, looking at liberation theology, and I'm looking at religious humanitarianism today. And then I have this kind of funky case where I went back and, or instance, where I decided I wanted to go back to an early modern case. And because I live in California now, I went to the Huntington Library and did some archival research on the mission era in California, in both Baja and Alta California, and how the Jesuits and Franciscans and others looked at the project of both creating Spanish satellites and missions to serve the king, but also their ethical understandings of what was justifiable in terms of use of force against the natives or the heathen or the Indians, and how much they felt that they could force conversion, which was really quite different if any of you have read De las Casas or Todorov on the conquest of the Americans. There's some similarities and differences. So I'm using more of a genealogical approach, but I'm also, rather than simply talking about how the mechanisms of the construction of power relations or the maintenance and reproduction of power relations, in a sense, in these different times, I'm really focusing more on the tensions, the ethical tensions over the use of force in these different times. So I am looking at some archival and then for the present day interview work some theology in each period, and finding some really fun stuff. Like, I didn't know liberation theologians referred back to the Kantian problem of individualism in the interwar period, but they do. And so I'm getting really into some of these things and having a lot of fun with it. But at the same time, I'm struggling again, and I guess I always will, with this issue of how broad, how narrow. And one way I'm thinking of these issues is to situate, and one of the things that in Audie in my book we talk a lot about is contextualization, that one of the things that social constructivists of various types do is place a big emphasis on contextualizing what it is they're looking at. And I'm beginning to look at this contextualization for this project and my current project, which takes the religious humanitarianism and looks more at how religious humanitarians operate in more culturally and religiously pluralist societies. And it's called Islamic and Interfaith Ethics in World Crises. And so I'm looking a lot at networks of humanitarians and how they, I'll be traveling to West Africa and Central Africa and also the Middle East to look at how these groups operate in those areas. But I'm beginning to look at this in terms of concentric circles, if you will, of contextualization. What is, for example, if I go back to this project that I'm writing, in the interwar period, the big debate, as we know, was from Reinhold Niebuhr, the notion of Christian realism. So Christianity was going to marry with realism. But yet there was this huge pacifist trend as well. So what is this tension between Christian realism and pacifism over the legitimacy of force, the morality of force, the legitimacy of force, etc.? And theologians often saw this in terms of Christianity vis-a-vis the world, or vis-a-vis a secular world. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, German confessional theologian who was beheaded by the Nazis and took part in a plot to kill Hitler at one point, he talked about the problem as how to live in a world come of age. And by that he meant how to be Christian in a secular world. So there was this perception of having to live by in the sort of American and European context, how to live in a world that was largely secular, which I think today we have a very different perception of the world. And I think theirs was clearly very limited because the world wasn't really a secular world in many ways. Liberation theologians took this kind of understanding and turned it upside down a little bit. It became less how to live in that kind of world, but how to live in a world in which people who profess the same kind of beliefs you do are part of structures that are engendering lots of violence. And do you then partake in counter-violence? And many did. And religious humanitarians today are in a very different position vis-a-vis the state, and they also have to work in a world of pluralism. Some proselytize, some don't. And so these are the kinds of questions then that I'm looking at, and I'm beginning to conceptualize this as, concentric circles of context. That's all to say that, again, I continue to struggle with some of the same issues, and I'm going to make a few concluding remarks here. For me, ethics and action are always at issue in philosophical questions, and that we as researchers are always implicated. Interpretive theorists, I think, are in the process of being more honest about our stances vis-a-vis the work we do. And I think this is a good move, and we should continue that move. I think how we use evidence is always key. I think that increasingly we have to keep specifying and justifying the evidence that we use. Very often people want an answer to what evidence to go to. I don't really think very often there is an answer. I think it's the question of being open to alternative interpretations, of being open to important evidence that really does speak to what you're doing, maybe that you didn't know about at first, but also starting out by saying, this is what I'm going to look at and this is why. I mean, there are very pragmatic ways of justifying what we look at and why we look at them and when we look at them. And I think this is important to get our work out there, to get our work understood, but also to really help real debate about our conclusions and what we are thinking. And I would also say that I think those of us who do interpretive work should be at the forefront of trying not to become ossified specimens of interpretation. In other words, I think we have to keep our thinking open to new conceptualizations and evidence and worldviews. So that's it. Thank you. Questions?
Questions for Cecilia Lynch.
Yes, MJ.
I like this idea of Patrick running around being Vanna White. We talk about being open to various kinds of evidence, but that then raises the question, is any conceivable thing evidence, or is there some line at which something goes from being evidence to just being such arrant BS that either we have to label it as BS and warn everybody against it, or simply leave it out of what we're doing?
Well, I think that that's an excellent question. And part of my struggle with Samuel Huntington is exactly that. To what degree do I think, I'll just be very honest here, you know, when I wrote a piece on Kant in 94, I thought, oh, this Huntington thing in 93 is ridiculous, and you know, I'm going to take that to task. And then it seemed like it was just so obvious that that you could run a truck through the gaps in the clash of civilization that, you know, it was sort of dead in the water. And then, you know, it seemed a total resurgence, especially after 9/11. But somewhat even before, I don't think it ever was as dead in the water. So I think that particular piece of Huntington's, and along with this current, I guess there's another tirade that's sort of connected against immigrant Hispanics, yes, in the U.S. So I guess I see that as, you know, pretty close to the this is BS. But on the other hand, it's been influential in punditry. And I'm also very interested in the relationship, and this was of interest to me in the Beyond Appeasement book. Punditry about the interwar period and about the narrative fitting into the meta-narrative of the interwar period, and the relationship between that and governmental use of terminology of discourse, and contestation of it. So I think that the question of what is so extreme and what is not, on the one hand, in terms of these kinds of authoritative things, I think for me we need to be wary of, more than anything, of creating straw people, right? So I think that for me I need to realize that the whole debate about the clash of civilizations business is really a range of debate. You know, I want to just dismiss the whole concept, but it is a range of debates, and some slide into things that are more of interest to me than others. And then I think that this also gets to the question posed to Lena about or her points about how you choose a text. I think we do need to be open to or to look for challenges always. In my work anyway, one of the things I focus on is the tensions that are posed by challenges to the quote-unquote authoritative texts. Now, which ones you choose, you do have to make very pragmatic decisions about that. And in my first book, I found that I made pragmatic decisions. For example, I didn't really deal with the communists, and I felt bad about that, but I just didn't deal with them. In this book, I'm really debating whether I deal with some of the, especially back in the interwar period, some of the far-right Christians, you know. On the one hand, it's very sexy to deal with those, but I don't want to set them up as the only kind of thing out there. What I really want to bring out the, you know, some of the other voices that aren't so stereotypical. So I think in part, you know, and I know this is often the answer that we give, in part it depends on your question. In part it also depends on, and this is where I think we need to be more and more honest about our own implication and what we are trying to accomplish as researchers. So I think what is subsumed under what is your question is, what is it you're trying to accomplish as a researcher? And where are you coming from, in a sense, ethically? And I think those are the things that guide you. And I think being forthright about that, at the very least, is important.
At a very practical level, yeah. I was wondering, especially when you're working with documents, how extensively do you directly quote them? Mm-hmm. Because in my own work, I want to show the people the documents I'm working with so they can see where I'm getting these ideas. But right. Then on the other hand, it has been argued that I don't put enough analysis in because I'm expecting right. the documents to speak for right. themselves. So.
Right. Well, I think you need to listen to that. When I work with students, sometimes students will, and I did this sometimes too, you know, you sort of refer to, you've read all these things, they start, like Jennifer Milliken says, they start replicating themselves, right? So you think, okay, well, there's something here because you've read enough of those. And so you summarize it and you put it in. But somebody else coming to that, the reader coming to that, thinks, well, wait a minute, where's your evidence for that? You know, and I'm not really convinced by your summary. So I think you do, part of this is also the getting the reader out there to comment. So you need to listen to those comments, and then you need to be more specific. In my work, I tend to have a combination of summary things and then sometimes citations. If it's really something that needs to be unpacked, you know, then, you know, if it's a paragraph or two, but it's really good stuff, put it in there. You know, if it's something that all of these different groups are saying it, then you can use a phrase quoting from one of them, but cite all of them and explain both times why these things are important. You always have to explain why they're important.
Can I just make one small add to that?
Sure, please.
Thank you.
Because, I mean, I completely agree with you, just sort of from a discourse analytical perspective, as a practical piece of advice for you, those of you who work with that, when you give a quote, you know, this is exemplifying, you know, a reading of a broader material, or it's because, you know, it really shows the boundary of the discourse, right? So the quote is there. Don't explain what the quote says, right? Don't spend half a page repeating the quote, but analyze it. I mean, I really see often that then there's half a page of just accounting for it, you know, because you could read what's in the quote, so go directly to the analysis.
That's a really good point. Thank you.
Jesse.
I was wondering if you could talk, if you could give an example. You were talking about concentric levels of contextualization. So I'm curious if you could give us an empirical example. What does it mean to contextualize sort of at different levels?
Okay, well, what I'm trying to think through, for example, going back to the interwar period, on the one hand, the way the pacifist just war debate was taking place was not simply in among religious circles. It was part of a broader debate post-World War I about whether force could ever be justified, whether the world was going to be hell-bent toward destruction if armies continued. So there's that kind of broader political/historical contextualization. Then there's the theological debate, if you will, or the theological developments, I should say, before we get to the theological debate. What's the theological context? And the theological context is, it concerns disillusioned socialists like Reinhold Niebuhr, and, you know, his interaction with other academics, because he's in academia. It includes, you know, people like Bonhoeffer in Germany who are trying to act, but who are totally conceptual in their theology. It includes what I think is still a problem in IR thinking about religion, which is this assumption that it's all about Kantian transcendence, you know, to another world. But I think in that particular period, that was part of, there was more of an individualism going on, at least that's how I would situate it. It wasn't all based on individual salvation notions, because there was this developing conception of social sin from the social gospel and other things like that. So one would be the sort of political, historical context, how the theological context works with that and is informed by that. And vice versa, because theologians were, you know, Niebuhr did a whole lot to help out Carr and Morgenthau and all these people trying to conceptualize the difference, you know, between individual ethics and, you know, the ethics of the state. So those kinds of things. And then how did people confronted with the rise of Nazism, of National Socialism and Hitler, how did they react to that in their understandings of what could be justified in terms of violence, force against these things conceptualized as evil, given that they also thought things like imperialism and power politics and things like that were evil. So how did these different groups, you know, how did they deal with that tension? So does that answer? Yeah.
To move on.
Can you speak a little bit more about the question you raised of whether you want to construct an alternative interpretation? And specifically, are there criteria for selecting this alternative interpretation that you have in mind? And how do you respond to the critique that this is simply a subjective judgment of what is better?
Right.
And how do you defend that?
Right. I don't necessarily defend it. I agree with it. But I think the way I defend it, I think that I will start there. I've thought a lot about my first book in terms of, you know, the more I've gotten into post-structuralist literatures. And I do think that there is a certain, you know, liberalism that emanates from it, right? But I also agree with somebody like Nathaniel Berman, who's a critical legal theorist, who says we're all late liberals. not in the sense that we're dead yet, but in the sense that, you know, we're all living in this era and we're all shaped by it. And even those of us who categorize ourselves or are categorized, you know, as very, you know, postmodern or whatever, you know, in our daily lives, I'm sorry, but I don't really see anybody out there living it, you know, in academia or anything like this. So, and very often in the research, it creeps in as well. It has to, because we're shaped by it. We're implicated in it. So I think that there are just degrees of that and degrees of awareness of it. So I'm a big advocate of saying, this is where I stand vis-a-vis that. And I say that my interpretation is shaped by the fact, you know, I've often said, my book was published in 99 by Cornell, and Cornell would probably not have, I don't know about Cornell, but, you know, a major IR publisher wouldn't have touched it 10 years earlier. I'm virtually convinced. And I think that, to me, what's really critical is keeping the space open for people doing different kinds of work. And so what I did then, I still stand by. I think it's a good piece of work, and I'm really pleased that historians have liked it, too. They gave me an award. I also feel that, you know, I've moved in certain ways from that time. So that is an interpretation which was part and parcel of the times, in a sense. You know, the 80s and the 90s and the contestation of IR theory and realism and security and you know, all of that stuff. I think it's a pretty darn good alternative interpretation, also because it's not overly rigid, but it is, you know, it's strong in its own way, and it can be contested, and that's part of being in this world of academia. And so I'm happy to, I mean, I'm very critical of E.H. Carr, and yet I know that, you know, all the cool Brits and everybody else loves E.H. Carr, you know, but I just got so ticked off reading the guy's documents when he was a labor office in the Foreign Office. I thought, you know, you hypocrite. But, so that colors my view of E.H. Carr. On the other hand, What Is History has a lot of good stuff in it. And, you know, so does that other book that I cite. So it does have, and over time, I'm able to distance myself from that and think, you know, this is my interpretation then. If I were to write it now, maybe I'd try to be a little bit more generous toward him.